From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone, and I'm joined now by senior reporter Heidi Ledford of Nature, the journal Nature. She joins me to run through some of the week's and the month's top science headlines. Heidi, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with a new policy from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency that has made a lot of headlines and prompted quite a strong response from the scientific community this week. And this is EPA Administrator Wheeler's announcement that there will be a phasing in of some very strict limits on animal testing of toxic chemicals, and in fact, an effort to completely eliminate animal testing by 2035. How has the research community responded to this announcement?
You know, I think everyone really wants to reduce animal testing to the extent that they possibly can. But, you know, among some environmental advocates and researchers, there is some concern that getting rid of it altogether like this could really hamper the EPA's ability to regulate chemicals.
I mean, it does create strange bedfellow collaborations where you've got PETA and the chemical industry, major players in the chemical industry, actually pushing together for this. I think that's probably raised some skepticism about the true motivation for this. And scientists saying, you know, things like cells in a dish and computer models can't really replace animals at this point for knowing whether or not a chemical is going to be harmful.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can do things with cells in a dish, and you can learn things from computer models, but in some cases, it's really not going to give you a complete picture.
And so the concern, presumably, is that this is a politically motivated way, actually, to make sure that we don't have that information?
Well, that is a concern that has been raised by some, yeah.
All right, switching topics here. There's a new study out, and this may be a little controversial as well in a different way, but the first hints that the body's biological age might be able to be reversed, that we could actually turn back time in a biological sense. So what has actually been accomplished, and, you know, are those kind of seemingly hyperbolic statements actually warranted?
Yeah, I think this one, I mean, it's a really interesting study, but it's one where you have to really use a lot of skepticism, I think, in looking at the results. What the researchers did is they took 9 healthy volunteers and gave them a cocktail of 3 drugs, growth hormone and a couple of diabetes drugs, and then looked at chemical markers on their DNA that change with what they call biological age.
And what is biological age?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So you could say, for example, that I'm 43 years old, just to pull a number from a hat, and that means that I was born 43 years ago. But my body, depending on my genetic background and the various kinds of, you know, maybe trauma that I've experienced over my life, my body could have characteristics that are typical of someone who's older or younger than 43. So there are a lot of different ways to try to assess that, which they would call biological age. And in this particular study, they've been looking at these chemical modifications to DNA that can change over time. These are called epigenetic markers.
We've heard in recent years that things as simple as diet and exercise might slow that molecular aging process, aging at its most fundamental level. It seems pretty remarkable that something as, at this point, mundane as growth hormones or diabetes drugs could be, you know, the elixir of youth, that something that mundane could actually reverse this process.
Well, that's, I think, where you really want to get into the caveats for the study. and again, not to criticize the study, because it's an exploratory study. You know, it's an important question and an interesting question. But it, you know, there was no control group in the study. There were only 9 people. All of the volunteers were middle-aged white men. They were only studied for a year, you know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, if there are any listeners out there who are sort of Googling how they can get their hands on some black market growth hormone or something, I would urge them not to do so.
I mean, one study, 9 people, no controls. It begs the question, why was this even published and why is this getting so much attention?
Well, I think, you know, it was probably published because it's as, you know, it is what it is. You can look at it and you can say, okay, well, this is only a study with 9 people and no control, and but it's looking at this question, and so here's what they've found, and maybe people want to carry this on and do a bigger study or look more closely at these particular mechanisms and so forth. You know, the reason it's getting as much attention as it is, it could be that people are a bit more hopeful about the results than they should be. But it is still an interesting scientific question, an interesting approach. You just really have to bear those caveats in mind.
Okay. From the inner workings of our cells to the complete opposite end of the size spectrum here with this next story, the South African Meerkat radio telescope has found what have been described as hourglass-shaped bubbles or balloons at the center of the Milky Way. What are these? What do we know about them at this point?
Well, so far, researchers think that these are remnants of explosions that occurred at the galaxy's center millions of years ago.
And how have we not seen them before? I mean, what are they made of, and why would they be hard to detect?
Well, they're thought to be gas structures, and they've been detected now because there's this fancy new radio telescope that's come online in South Africa recently called Meerkat. But they're visible to the radio telescopes because there are these electrons stirring around inside the sort of gas bubbles, you could say, and those electrons are producing radio waves as they're accelerated by magnetic fields. So that's why the radio telescopes are able then to pick them up.
Last but not least, Heidi, there's some new research. One of those things where the headline, the bottom line of this really seems like a statement of the obvious, but new research that false statements about climate change can trip people up. What's actually going on with this work?
Yeah, this one, I don't know, it's almost a glass half empty, half full kind of thing. You can decide how to look at it. There was a survey that was carried out in Germany. 500 volunteers. They were presented with 8 scientific statements about the causes and effects of climate change, and they were asked to evaluate which statement was true, which ones were false, and then also to report how confident they felt in that assessment. And it turns out they did, overall pretty well, particularly when it came to identifying the true statements, and they felt confident about their results, and most of the time they were correct. But where things fell down a bit was in pinpointing the statements that were false. And even though they weren't as accurate on that front, they were just as confident in their answers as they were when they were answering things correctly.
So maybe we don't collectively know as much about climate science as we think we know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's possible. It could have some, implications for how various stakeholders in this discussion, choose to shape their messages for the public overall. But I also, I kind of think misinformation is such a great and growing problem at the moment, even beyond climate change, that everything we can learn about ways that we can be misled and how that can happen without us even suspecting it. I think that the data we can get on that could be useful in a lot of different ways.
Well, you can't fix a problem if you don't know it's there. So we'll
right.
put that in that category. That is senior reporter Heidi Ledford of the journal Nature. Thank you so much, Heidi.
Thank you, Heather.
This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, many times more powerful than carbon dioxide. It is also the main ingredient in natural gas, and leaks from natural gas pipelines and other infrastructure can be a major source of methane emissions to the atmosphere. In fact, a new estimate of methane leaks in cities along the Northeast Corridor finds the amount could be twice what the EPA officially budgets. Eric Court is an associate professor of atmospheric, oceanic, and space sciences at the University of Michigan and co-author of that recent survey of methane leaks in the Northeast. Eric, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Methane is more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. What does that actually mean when we say that?
Yes. So for methane, if we emit a pound of methane, it is equivalent of emitting considerably more pounds of CO2. And the relative comparison depends on the time frame of interest. So typically people think 100-year time frame, in which case a pound of methane is equivalent to about 30-some pounds of CO2. If we consider on a 20-year time frame, it's equivalent to about 80-some pounds of CO2.
And why does it change over time?
Because methane is reactive in the atmosphere, so it actually decays. Whereas CO2 persists for very long times, methane decays in about 10 years. So even though the methane molecule is more potent, it does go away. And this is part of the appeal of it from a mitigation perspective, in that if we actually reduce our human emissions of methane, it will cause the levels of methane in the atmosphere to actually decline.
And do so much more quickly than if we're cutting carbon dioxide emissions.
That's correct.
So that presumably then is behind this idea that natural gas as a fuel, methane as a fuel, is a cleaner or better option than something like coal or oil.
Well, yeah, the comparison between natural gas as a fuel and coal or oil, there's many layers that one can consider. It's certainly cleaner from an air quality perspective. There's less of air quality impacts from natural gas. From a climate perspective, more energy is produced per molecule of CO2 produced. But the question is, how much methane do you lose before you combust it, which compromises the benefits? And it's one of these situations that could be considered a win-win, because losing methane along the way is bad for the climate, but it also isn't really efficient from an energy perspective, because you're wasting this resource that you could combust for energy.
Right. I mean, that was going to be my next question, is why is so much methane lost in the process of extracting and transporting natural gas, when in fact that is the product that is being sold and used?
There's a number of reasons. One is it's simply difficult to take such large volumes of gas, pull them out of the ground in one place, process them to make it more pure methane than what comes out of the ground, transport it along hundreds and thousands of miles of pipelines. You will inevitably lose some along such a system. There still is more lost than we think needs to be lost, and that's for a combination of different reasons. Some of it is likely related to just old infrastructure, and some of it is related to not knowing where the emissions or losses are, and some of it is the economic incentive doesn't line up. If it would cost, let's say, $100,000 to repair methane lost in one part of the system, and it only costs $100 a year for that part to be leaking in lost methane, it doesn't typically make sense to, from an economic perspective, to fix it. And then there's another economic element, which is that often the people that are responsible for the loss of the gas often don't own that gas and maybe not incentivized to not lose it.
Well, Eric Kort, you and your colleagues set out to measure methane leaks, methane emissions from the pipeline system, essentially around Northeast cities. How do you actually go about doing that?
Yeah, so we set out to study actually the methane emissions from anything and everything in the city. So not just the gas systems, but actually from anything else that can contribute, including things like landfills. And we did this by equipping an aircraft with instrumentation that could measure gases like methane and carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, as well as ethane. And these are all different trace gases in the atmosphere. And it's a useful tool, so we can take the aircraft, fly around each one of these cities. We can see an elevated emissions plume that comes from these cities. So there's elevated carbon dioxide, and that comes about due to all the different combustion processes, the cars, the home heaters, all of those things. It mixes in the atmosphere, and we get this big plume off of the city. By measuring methane, we can actually look at what the methane looks like in this plume and see from that relationship how much methane is actually being emitted from the city.
And the end result of what you found was that a lot of methane is being emitted from these cities, a lot more than the EPA has typically budgeted.
That's correct. We found that these cities we measured, which was Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, Providence, and Boston, and New York City, all emitted roughly twice the amount of methane that's currently budgeted in the inventory. And actually, we're able to look at multiple gases to identify that most of that methane that we saw indeed was coming from natural gas systems and not from systems like landfills. And so it's why we can pinpoint that it's somewhere in this local distribution and end use of gas that this elevated emissions is emerging.
Let's talk about some of the other work that has been done in this sphere, Eric Kort. Your new study, one of the cities you looked at is Boston, as you said. There was a 2015 study in the Boston area. How do your results compare to that study?
It's very broadly consistent with some slight differences. So that study also found elevated emissions of methane relative to the inventories inventories have changed a little bit since the time of that study. We also found elevated emissions relative to the inventories. That study attributed the bulk of that to the natural gas system, which again was consistent with our study, which attributed the bulk of it to the natural gas system. The actual spatial extents of our studies are not quite the same, so it can be hard to dive into some other comparative details simply because we sampled a slightly different region than they did in that study. But the broad conclusions are very similar.
Your research is not wildly different than that previous study is, I guess, kind of the take home there. And there have also been efforts in the past couple of years to try to synthesize all the data that's out there and get a sense of what that might say about methane emissions from the oil and gas pipeline system and use system as a whole. One of those last year found that methane emissions were at least 60% higher than those EPA inventories that you were talking about. Your work finds that it may be 100% higher, maybe fully twice or even three times what those EPA inventories are. Why so much higher? What might explain those discrepancies?
So that previous study, the 60% was considering the end-to-end system, right? So it's actually looking at all the different components. In this case, we're only looking at this kind of distribution and use part of the system. So it's not actually necessarily a disagreement between what we find in that study. It's more that we're focused only on one component of the natural gas system.
Eric Court, one of the key comparisons that you make in this study that you've just recently published is your estimates of methane emissions compared to EPA inventories. And you've said that a few times in our conversation already. What are those inventories? What is the significance of them? And what are they used for?
So inventories serve a number of different purposes, but the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency puts together inventories on emissions of greenhouse gases in the U.S., and this is used for reporting internationally for what we think our emissions are of greenhouse gases, and it's also used internally for tracking what these emissions are. So it's really the tool by which our government assesses what our greenhouse gas emissions are. It is based on the inventory.
Eric Court, put all of this into perspective. Given that there are many other sources of methane, how important are these methane leaks from the natural gas supply chain, and how important is it that they are underestimated in these EPA inventories? Is this more of an academic footnote to the methane story, or is this the main event?
It's a good question. I actually tend to think of this work and these findings as more providing really appealing mitigation opportunities. And that as we find that emissions tend to be higher than we thought they were, but also identify better where they're coming from and that they may indeed, in fact, be addressable, it's actually a really favorable opportunity where we could actually reduce emissions that have significant climate impact in an efficient way that does not require large structural changes.
And as you said, a potential win-win that we're actually recapturing a fuel and a saleable product.
That's correct.
Eric Court is an associate professor of atmospheric, oceanic, and space sciences at the University of Michigan and co-author on a recent estimate of methane leaks in cities in the Northeast. Eric, thanks so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, new research hints at the impact of the Me Too movement, both positive and negative. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. 2 years ago, a tweet by actress Alyssa Milano set off a landslide of women sharing their experiences of sexual abuse and harassment. As the Me Too movement gained steam, prominent men in positions of power were toppled by accusations. But did the movement actually change behavior? Is sexual harassment less prevalent than it used to be? A recent survey of 500 women suggests that the answer is yes and also no. Some types of harassment appear to have declined, while others have surged. Stephanie Johnson is an associate professor of management at the University of Colorado Boulder's Leeds School of Business, and she's co-author of that recent study measuring the impact of the Me Too movement. Stephanie, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you.
The study that you've just published actually compares surveys conducted in 2018 to a survey from September of 2016. Presumably, that survey was not planned to predate the Me Too movement. You couldn't have known that was going to start a year later. So what was the actual goal of that research? What were you looking for at that point in 2016?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story. So we started out doing a qualitative study looking at women's experiences in the workplace. And we had interviewed a bunch of women in 2016. And many of those women actually mentioned sexual harassment as part of their workplace experience, which in 2016, it seemed pretty surprising for us as researchers. You know, we know sexual harassment exists, but we didn't know quite the prevalence. So in our case, 80% of the women said they'd been sexually harassed. So that's why we designed the survey to see, you know, is there something about the people who we chose to interview that was different than the normal population? And we found, you know, not really, that a lot of women were experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace. And so we might have been, you know, the only people who were not surprised by the start of the Me Too movement soon after that.
So talk a little bit about how you do select the women who are involved in this survey. I mean, demographics, careers, you know, who are the survey participants and what kinds of questions are you asking them?
Oh, sure. So we used what's called a Qualtrics panel. So a survey company gathers people who fit your needs. And so we did women in the United States who were working full time between the ages of 20 and 40. And they are participants in research studies, just like kind of generally. And so they're just randomly selected to participate. So it should be a pretty national random sample.
So give us a little bit more about the detail about the baseline. September 2016, you do this survey. More than 80% of the women report some sort of sexual harassment in the workplace. But what does that actually mean? What were they experiencing and how was it affecting them?
Right. So in the 2016 survey, quite a few women reported sexual harassment. And we also asked them the extent to which they had lowered self-esteem and more self-doubts. And not surprisingly, consistent with past research, women who'd experienced sexual harassment had lower self-esteem and more self-doubts about their competence. And we looked at sexual harassment in kind of three different ways that are commonly assessed. And that is unwanted sexual attention, that might be comments or leering. And on top of that, we measured sexual coercion, which is just exactly what it sounds like, being offered either favors or threatened with punishment for not complying with sexual favors. And then the third one is what we call gender harassment. So it's still part of the concept of sexual harassment, but it's not overtly sexual in nature. So it might, in fact, be negative comments like, you know, this woman's incompetent or women can't get the job done kind of thing.
So, Stephanie Johnson, you did that survey in September of 2016, and then following the rise of the Me Too movement, you essentially repeated that survey in September of 2018. How much did the situation change in that time?
So there's quite a few changes. One of the, I guess, most important changes that I feel is that the link between the different types of sexual harassment and self-esteem or self-doubts actually decreased. So even women who were still experiencing sexual harassment seemed to blame themselves less in a way or didn't let it affect them in the same way. And we saw that in the qualitative interviews that we did as well, because we actually went back and interviewed the same women who we interviewed in 2016 who started this whole study. And they said the same thing 2 years later, that knowing that this is such a prevalent phenomenon and that there's other people who experience the same thing and would support them actually meant that they felt less self-blame for the sexual harassment they experienced. And in terms of the amount of sexual harassment. So I'll break it down in those three different areas. So for unwanted sexual attention, back in 2016, 66% of women reported receiving sexual advances, comments, staring, touching. In 2018, that 66% dropped to 25%. That's a pretty big drop.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a really dramatic drop.
It is, yeah. And then sexual coercion was 25% of women in 2016, and then only 16% of women in 2018, which is, again, it's a substantial drop if you think of the percentage, because, you know, a lot fewer women are experiencing sexual coercion. But then the sort of, I guess, sad story of the research was that the gender harassment, which is the hostility toward women on the basis of their sex, went from 76% in 2016 to 93% in 2018. So with the decline in the other two, we saw almost a corresponding increase in general hostility toward women.
Any ideas what could be going on there? I mean, you start to speculate about why the Me Too movement might cause an increase in gender harassment, but is there anything you can actually draw from your data that starts to hint at why?
Yeah. So in the survey data, we didn't survey any men and we didn't ask the women why they thought this would happen because we didn't know, you know, what was going to happen. But in the interviews, we asked women what they were experiencing and they interestingly talked about this increase in gender harassment as a sort of backlash effect that increased tension between men and women in the workplace. Women pushing more for equality is causing some men who might have been prone to sexually harass them in terms of sexual coercion or unwanted sexual attention to stop those behaviors, but instead have this general hostility toward women. And some women said that men were kind of doubling down on their hostility and aggression toward women. And one of the interviews, a woman said, a gentleman had asked her how she got this amazing mentor that she had. And she made kind of a snarky response. She said, we call it networking. And he responded with, if you ever speak to me like that again, I will punch you in the face. That's like, or hit you in the face. That's like a really aggressive, shocking response. Like, I can't imagine anyone ever saying that in a workplace context. But I think there is this increased tension that a lot of people feel in the workplace. Men who talk about being afraid of being falsely accused of sexual harassment. Women who feel like men are less likely to mentor them and go to workplace dinners with them and things like that. So there's like a general tension around the Me Too movement that we've seen in a lot of different research.
Stephanie Johnson, in your study, you write that your data suggests that the changes in sexual harassment, or the prevalence of sexual harassment, are due to the increased scrutiny on the topic coming from the Me Too movement. And with some of the qualitative questions of, you know, women, how they are responding to or being affected by sexual harassment, they can clearly identify, you know, I feel more supported because people are talking about this. When it comes to either the decrease in unwanted attention or coercion within the workplace or this backlash increase in gender harassment, how do we know that that's really the Me Too movement? I mean, how do we actually start to get at that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess a challenge with this research is, you know, we don't know that any of this is causal, right? We took a snapshot in 2016 and we took a snapshot in 2018. And, you know, when we wrote the paper, normally in research articles, there's a section of hypotheses and what we think is going to happen. And we didn't write hypotheses because I would say we really didn't know what to expect from the Me Too movement. And probably the easiest guess would be that nothing's changed, right? Because change is difficult. And oftentimes we don't see change for decades on issues like this. So I guess the truth is, I don't know that it's because of the Me Too movement. The only thing I would say is that the interviews we did at the same time or before knowing the results of the survey, And they were really quite similar in terms of women's responses. They felt like there's less overt sexual harassment or sexual coercion in organizations, that HR departments are taking it more seriously, that the organization had done more training or updated their policies on sexual harassment to be stronger. And those were, you know, comments that they said that they personally noticed over the last 2 years. And then at the same time, they also thought that there was this increase in hostility that came as a result of the Me Too movement. So other than those women's accounts, I mean, I guess we can never really say that that's for sure what's happening, but I feel like their responses were pretty compelling because they didn't see the results of our survey, but they right. had really similar experiences.
We actually spoke with another researcher recently who also ended up doing surveys before and after the start of the Me Too movement. And in that case, she found that people who were asked to evaluate a made-up resume, essentially, one which included accusations of sexual harassment in the workplace and one which didn't, that over the course of the Me Too movement, the tendency to kind of retaliate against or punish women who report sexual harassment had decreased, suggesting that there's not just a decrease or a change in the behavior of men who might commit sexual harassment within the workplace or women in how they respond to that, but a broader societal change in how this is being viewed and the acceptability of this behavior within the workplace. And to me, the fact that we could see, even in just a couple of relatively small studies, what seem like pretty dramatic changes in the course of a year.
Yeah.
Is pretty shocking. I mean, is that surprising to you that you could see such dramatic changes in such a short period of time?
I mean, for sure, right? Like, it's amazing. I think when Alyssa Milano shot out that tweet or Facebook post, I doubt she could have ever imagined the impact that it would have. But I think for maybe, you know, the last 20 years, sexual harassment has been something that was really swept under the rug. Women in our first set of interviews said, you know, most of them said they never reported their sexual harassment because they knew that they would experience backlash. One woman said she did report it and she lost her job. She was fired basically for reporting sexual harassment. Other women said, even if I reported it and the person were fired, it would ruin my career. Like, that's it. I would be the woman who complained about sexual harassment. But I think no one knew how prevalent this was. And so if someone said they were experiencing it, it's like you kind of wonder, was it her? And I think even, you know, as we saw women start to come forward, there was a lot of implied or just blatant skepticism. Like, really? Did that happen to this woman? In a way that's really similar to what we see in things like sexual assault, right? People often doubt and punish the victim. But when 80% of women or 93% of women are saying they experience these things in the workplace, you start to think, you know, I'm pretty sure it's not that woman's fault, or I'm pretty sure it's not something that woman did to deserve this, because it's happening to all women. And I think until we knew that was the case, I think women were blaming themselves too. And I think maybe a more broad impression of what we're seeing in terms of social movements is just that with Twitter and the internet and social media, we have so much more power to share information like this and to really create change. Like, it's, to me, it really shows how important people's voices are and the strength in numbers and the power in supporting women, women supporting women. And then, you know, I've seen some really amazing men step forward through this as well and say, I didn't know this was going on, but I'm going to be a champion for women now that I know this is happening. And so I think there's just a lot of power in that.
Stephanie Johnson is an associate professor of management at the University of Colorado Boulder's Leeds School of Business and co-author on a recent study measuring the impact of the Me Too movement on sexual harassment in the workplace. Stephanie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great day.
Up next, college students and NASA scientists head off to explore Earth's newest island. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We know that many islands in the Pacific Ocean formed from volcanic activity, but we haven't gotten to watch the process happen very often. After all, it doesn't happen every day. But in 2015, it did. A volcanic eruption created a new landmass that connected two existing islands in Tonga, Hunga Tonga and Hunga Haape. And the fact that the new island is still around 4 years later is also pretty rare. It's only the third new island in 150 years to last more than a few months. Scientists at NASA think the new island could shed light on early volcanic activity on Mars, and rather than studying it with remote imaging and rovers, they've teamed up with Sea Education Association to sail there, literally, and study it in person. Jim Garvin is chief scientist of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and Carrie Whitaker is assistant professor of oceanography at Sea Education Association, and they join me both in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, I've seen photos of this new island, and it actually looks Photoshop. It looked fake because there are these two beautiful, green, lush, tropical islands, and then there's this stretch of black lava and the top of a volcano kind of sticking out of it. I mean, what's it like to actually be there?
Well, this is the kind of place that we always dream of because it's about as primeval as you can get. You know, explosion of liquid rock with water producing cone-like landscapes with craters. It's literally Mars on Earth. And when you get one that goes through those processes in front of your eyes, our eyes as people, our eyes from satellites, we get a chance to sort of play the tape backwards. We haven't seen them happen through the eyes of 21st century technology and experience. So this is very otherworldly and spectacular to see. And it really does evoke the magic of what we think is happening on other planets like Mars, planets that had a watery past that now look different. So we go to Earth to explore Mars.
I mean, that's pretty neat in and of itself. Let's take a step back and talk about what we know about how this island actually formed. I mean, volcanic eruption, right? But some of the details, how did this actually come about?
So sometime in probably the middle of 2014, liquid rock 100 meters under the ocean erupted through a crack. And with the water pressure of 100 meters of water, it probably oozed out as what we call pillow lavas. And over a period of the next 6 months, it built a table up from the seafloor in the Pacific within a bigger volcano, the Hunga Caldera, to form a plateau on which the lava, the liquid rock, was close enough to the air through the water to explode. When water hits 3,000-degree rock, it's not going to be too happy. It will blow up into fragmental debris. And that produced the growth of this ash volcano. And typically, those ash volcanoes form and they wash away. But this one had enough stuff, enough special conditions to last longer than anticipated and to give us that record of how these things grow up. So it's going through its life stages as we visit, as we watch, as we learn. And that's a rare commodity.
And how frequently does something like this actually happen?
So in the last 100 years, scientists on Earth, of course, where we are, have witnessed two. One in Capelinhos in the Azores Islands of the Central Atlantic, part of Portugal. In 1957-58, Capelinhos erupted. Lots of attention right in the International Geophysical Year. And then in 1963, and then for the next couple of years, Surtsey, the God of Fires volcano, erupted off the coast of Iceland. Both of them have survived for decades, and we use them as kind of record books. But they were witnessed through the technology of the 50s and 60s. And since then, we've gotten better. We can study them remotely. We can visit them through sailing ships with students. We have new techniques. And so now we can watch one from its earliest stages, from space, from ship, from foot, from laboratory gear that can see things as a billionth of a meter scale. we have the whole shebang now applied to this special place in Tonga, which is like a gift from Mother Nature.
I want to talk about this idea of actually sailing there, right? Because we think, as you're saying, all of this new technology and the sensors and the satellites and all of the detail of measurement that we can get to. And then we're talking about going to this island on a 135-foot sailing ship. I mean, why sail there as opposed to taking some other big modern research vessel there?
We can get closer. And Sea Education Association has sailed to very remote places in the world for almost 50 years. There's so many exciting elements of this collaboration. First, that there aren't charts for this new island.
Carrie Whitaker, as a person sailing on that ship, that's actually got to be a little bit scary, right? I mean, you're literally going into uncharted waters.
It's scary. It's romantic. You know, my background's in oceanography. I've been on large research vessels. Sailing and doing oceanography it really combines all of the elements of navigation, of the physics of the wind, of movement. There's so much history and culture in terms of navigation in Polynesia, where we'll be sailing. So, yeah, really this mission combines all of those elements and involves students in it from charting the waters, charting this new place, to actually setting foot on the island and collecting data that will inform these large questions about how islands evolve over time and erode. So
give us a sense of what this mission actually will be. I mean, the island's, it's been about 4 years, 3.5 years since the island formed. What's the goal at this point? 5 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was 2015 that it appeared.
So the island appeared and it stopped its eruptive phase in late January of 15. And we got the first high-resolution satellite images and the first people ever touched foot on the island in about March, when it was still hot and pretty unstable. The first visits by scientists were by a big team of scientists was by the Sea Education Association last year in a pilot study to bring students, some of our NASA scientists and satellite data all together to see what we could do, sort of simulating how we might send people to Mars. So it's a window into the workings of the Earth that we can apply forward in the oceans and to Mars.
Okay, so explore that, Jim Garvin, a little bit more, this and Mars part, because obviously this is cool. It's a new island on Earth. It tells us how volcanoes and volcanic islands form on our planet. What does that have to do with Mars?
So Mars may not look like it, but Mars is a water planet. Its water stories are hidden in the rocks that we've been crawling over with robots. We'll have students act like our robots much better with the mission coming up next month. But Mars' water story is a complicated one because Mars has things that are fundamentally not like Earth. Tremendous climate change due to its rotational axis variations, a smaller world, less internal heat. Lots of factors that give us, it's a magical control experiment by Mother Nature. We think Mars had standing, persistent bodies of water into which volcanoes erupted, like this one in Tonga. However, the water's gone. It's either frozen out, oxidized rocks, or evaporated away into the current climate state. So we see these landforms, hundreds of them, thousands of them in some cases, in a state of arrested development. Something happened, they formed, it's gone. The record books are gone. It's like archaeology of other planetary landscapes. So we need to see how the records might have worked when Mars had water, water erosion, eruptions into water, even microbial systems, if it had those, that might have worked in the presence of water. So this little volcano is going to be a training site for us to say, ooh, those things on Mars that kind of look like that, that we see with satellites, that we're not visiting with women and men, students like SEA student crew. What can we learn by seeing what a real one did on Earth, where there's waves and rain and wind and erosion and gravitational collapse, all those things mixed together? It's kind of a perfect story. And if we can read the records back on Mars, we can say more about how much water, how long it lasted, and that has implications for the biological potential and the possible records of said potential in the rocks on Mars, which is a big goal for understanding.
I mean, so you can kind of look at this and see, okay, this is what it looks like when this happens. Oh, look, I see that here, here, and here on Mars, so that must have happened there. But, okay, that one looks different. Something else
exactly
happened there.
Exactly. And we're doing it all now, thanks to the students from SEA, thanks to new satellite techniques, in 3D. So we're seeing the shape of things at scales from inches to meters to decameters on this island in ways that in the 50s and 60s were virtually impossible. I mean, you'd have to have teams of surveyors crawling over dangerous volcanoes. Now we use drones and satellites and students when we can.
So, Carrie Whitaker, mm-hmm. what is it that the students and Sea Education Association with the pilot study last year and again coming up with this new mission have actually done? What does that give us that our amazing detailed three-dimensional imagery doesn't give us?
Sure. So we've got the sailing vessel. We also have a small boat that will be able to deploy a side scan sonar and map the caldera, so near shore of the island that a larger vessel couldn't do. So we'll be doing some surveys there. We'll be setting foot on the island and putting out some GPS markers that then we can use some drone surveys and ground those flights in GPS marking.
Okay, so just, yeah, literally a way to say, okay, that's where we are.
Yeah, yep. And then align that with the satellite data as well. There is a crater lake on the island. We also have a plan to get some bathymetry mapping, so mapping of what that crater lake looks like under the surface of the water. And to do that, we'll be deploying two pack rafts that are combined as kind of a catamaran and deploying the side scan sonar to map the bottom. And that's something that we'll be doing with students. Vegetation surveys are another thing that we can do on foot to really get that ground truthing data. Bird surveys. Another remarkable element of the island that was discovered last year is all of the debris, marine debris that's been washed up. So we'll be cataloging that as well, measuring it, and then taking it off the island as much as we can.
That presumably is something that we're not going to find on Mars.
Well, you know, do we know that, Heather? But I think the other dimension of the students is they are the super intelligent, informed explorers that will be the first wave of how we start to think about how those kind of explorations happen when we do send women and men to Mars.
We've already mentioned that the island is eroding somewhat, which I have to say my first reaction to that was, wait, you think you've just put all of this new rock and created this new land. It's already going away. I mean, do we have a sense it has lasted 5 years? That's longer than most new volcanic islands apparently managed to survive. Do we have a sense of how long it will be with us?
Well, that's one of the big questions. Why has it survived? We think this island is supported by a large plateau of lava under the undersea part of the island that produces kind of like a shelf on top of which this cone sits. And that's given it the longevity of almost 5 years relative to what was anticipated by the experts. We all thought 3 months to 6 months, gone, that's cool. Now we're coming into 5 years, and our work that we published last year as very preliminary suggests maybe 30 to 100 years as an island system. And that's a great natural laboratory. That's long enough to see cycles of climate, decadal ones, interannual ones, see how ecological colonization affects those things. Sea level rise integrated over 30 to 100 years is an issue. This is a time-lapse view of new land in an Earth system that's changing. And that's a great opportunity. And the students get to be part of it at the ground floor. They will see things that won't be there next year. Or the year after that.
Jim Garvin is chief scientist of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, and Carrie Whitaker is assistant professor of oceanography at Sea Education Association. And together, they are working on exploring Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'ape, the newest island on Earth, formed about 5 years ago. Thank you so much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you, Heather.
Thanks, Heather. Let's go.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.